override the processor tax. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And I, that's true. You, not the way they did it. You can't do that. There's no authority in the Constitution to do that. And rightly, they threw it out. And so then Congress came back and heard George Peake talking about parity and said, well, let's try some of that then. And so what they didn't grasp was what Wilkin discovered was the rate. How much parity do we need?
Well, he didn't have that out there.
Correct. No, it wasn't there. The research was not available to him.
And that would have helped Peake, too, because Peake was along the right track.
Yep.
It's just that the data that Wilkin was able to uncover and analyze was what made the difference.
Yep.
And I think the other thing is Peake was really an impressive, you know, Sue was right. I'm reading that book by Gilbert Fite.
Oh, okay.
And he was extremely impressive as a just, you know, in terms of not only what he accomplished, but, you know, how he thought and approached things and all of that.
Yeah.
The fact that he was a friend of Bernard Baruch, such a good lifelong friend, you know, like Sue keeps puzzling over that, and sometimes I do too. But Baruch didn't see, understand, or grasp Peake's concern about international trade.
Right. No, because he was sitting above the fray. Baruch was. Baruch was to some degree benefited by the current state of affairs with international trade. And so for him to come down, for Baruch to come down on Peake's side about being particular about how the treaties were arranged, negotiated, and settled to get a handle on what we would call parity tariffs would have affected Baruch's income.
So did he resist that psychologically, or, you know, was there something?
Well, I think he was, he may have considered it, but thought that it was, well, probably among other things, he probably thought that Peake was a dabbler, you know, and that the experts that Baruch knew in international trade around the world were much more whispering confidence about do this or do that, and oh, you don't want to go there, and oh, we better keep this over here.
So we can equate Hovert's perception. Parity were dabblers. Parity people were dabblers, and Keynesians were intellectual experts. And he's not, has no freaking clue of what he's talking about.
That's right. No, he himself, Hovert, is prone to the dismissal of all kinds of things with the wave of his hand.
Yeah, right. So you have to really push back on him. And to me, right now, from my perspective, he's not worth it at this particular point. But
he's an internationalist by training.
Okay.
He does not. He's not an American citizen, is he?
I don't know.
I don't think he is.
Hmm.
I mean, we could ask Stephen, I guess, but in other words, all I'm saying is his interests are not here domestically.
But he still thinks.
Where is he from?
I think he's a Dane or
Netherlands, someplace like that. Yeah.
Yep. He's Netherlander.
Dutch. He's Dutch.
Okay.
Dutch. Okay. Niederlander. Yeah.
Yeah. He's friends with. That's how I think he found Verhagen.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, and all those European economists. Yep.
Yeah. So it's like, but he seems to misinterpret the Indian situation too, where he's located right now.
Right.
Well, India is a pretty big country, so you're holed up in one little place, and that's what you see. And
what was it Gandhi said? India is 600,000 villages.
Okay, yeah. I think
and that was 80 years ago.
Yeah.
Or 100 years ago.
Well, awesome. I'm thinking how to make, you know, just reading through this Gilbert Fite book, how to elevate the thinking the parity thinking that went on in the 20s that led up to Wilkins' discovery. Anyway, sorry, Lee.
I was just going to say, when you think of Dutch, they were the original modern imperialists.
Right. Well, the English East India Company was organized in 1600. The but Dutch East India Company was organized in 1602.
But the English Central Bank was from the Dutch. They learned how to do banking from the Dutch.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And if you look at Europe, the Dutch have always been, mm-hmm. for their small size, the most prosperous, the most economically advanced of all the European countries.
Well, and it's brought with it some liberality. I mean, that was where the Protestants, the Pilgrims, went when they got kicked out of England. They went to Holland first, and then they made their way back through England into the North American continent. That's where our English ancestry came from.
Yeah. There's a story there, though. The reason they left was because the successive generations were becoming too much like the Dutch, and the Puritans didn't like it.
Yep.
That's so they weren't kicked out. They left.
Yeah. Yep. And yet they still brought with them the abhorrence of the feudal system and its institution, therefore, of extreme private ownership of real estate and all the rest of this stuff. And as you know, we're still suffering under those problems, those delusions of ownership. That was what, you know, the only colony of the original 13 that actually made the attempt to buy their way onto the land here was Rhode Island. Roger Williams. There's a story there, too.
Yeah, right. What do you mean by the way? By their way?
Purchase the land from the Indians.
Well, the way I understood it was that the settlers, not all of them, but the settlers would.
It didn't happen with Pennsylvania. Penn came in and took over.
Yeah, right. That's true.
The Dutch did in New York. I mean, they tried to buy Manhattan Island, but that was a snicker and a laugh up the sleeve. Ah, look, we can get these rubes to take beads. Ha! You know, that was a cheating deal. Boston, the Pilgrims, the Puritans, neither one of them made the attempt to buy or make an arrangement whereby they would exchange anything of value for the land that they occupied. Roger Williams did. He went back to England to get permission within the grant for Providence Plantations, or Plymouth, Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, which is the actual name of the state, to get permission written into the Constitution that they would survive only by making a deal with the natives for the exchange of value on the land occupied.
What a value did they give the Indians?
I don't remember now, but there was the story, the upshot of the story is that Roger Williams himself, they still had terrible relations in many instances with the Indians, with the local people there in Rhode Island. And at one point, there was a band of Indians who were going to raid one of the settlements because the settlers had kept mucking up, either shooting, killing the Indians, or taking too much property, or whatever it was, and they were going to come and cut down the white population here because they're just kicking up their heels too much. And Roger Williams heard about it, and he went down to the settlement, and he goes out to meet the Indians coming at the settlement. And the Indians, to a person, said, he's a good guy, leave him alone. And they went around him and attacked the white settlement. So they had regard for the way he conducted himself and tried to run the Rhode Island state or colony. They respected that. They respected that gesture, although they still had problems with some of the people there. And in fact, Roger Williams himself took in all kinds of of people that got kicked out of other colonies that went to Rhode Island because of Roger Williams, because he said, I don't care who you are, you get to say what's on your mind here. That's what we're about. We're about tolerance. I may not like you. In fact, I think you ought to get your ass out of here. But we're a tolerant place. You can stay here until you find something better to move on. I mean, it has limits, but it's, you know, the tolerance exercised by Williams himself was of a high level. And people recognize that and respect it. You earn respect that way. At least you used to. I think it still works. It's just that these days it's under such a burden of lies, deceit, greed, emotional excess, that it's hard to draw a bead on these days.
So Randy, going back to the American experience with declaring the 601-602 emergency.
Yeah.
So it was a good thing, therefore, that the Congress declared that emergency, since people were starving?
Well, it was a way. I don't know. It was good for a while during World War, during and after World War II. It worked out well. It established from 42 to 52, or 43 to 52, a 10-year period there. It worked out advantageously.
And those laws in the 40s, parity laws, were based on 601-602?
Exactly. Yep. Yep. Yes, with the Wilkin adjustments. When Wilkin and Ray and Adkerson and Coulter were working with Congress to try to implement a sensible parity policy. Yeah.
So the power of Congress to declare that emergency is a power given to them in the Constitution.
Yeah. Yeah, where it says Congress has the power to declare war. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. The curiosity, like I was saying, the curiosity about that declaration of emergency is that it was declared by Congress. And in the bill, in the original AAA bill, Section 1, which is 7 U.S.C. 601, Section 1 of the bill declared the emergency. Section 2 of the bill, which is 7 U.S.C. 602, declared the policy of Congress, the regulation of the markets to establish parity prices to farmers. To farmers, meaning at the first point of sale of the agricultural raw materials. Section 13 of the original AAA declared how the emergency was to end. And in 1937, after the Butler decision threw out the processor tax, they weren't sure how much of the AAA had been thrown out. And so Congress came back, and that was in 36. In 37, Congress came back and they reenacted. They affirmed, validated, and reenacted without change the following sections of the AAA. Section 1, which is 601. Section 2, which is the Declaration of Policy, parity. And several others they listed. And the one that was not reenacted was Section 13. So how to end the emergency was never reenacted.
Interesting. Wonder why.
It fell out of their heads.
And what does it say how to end it?
They said, the president will tell us when it's over.
That's it?
Yep. And he never has.
Right. The church committee went over that.
Yeah, and you will not find the emergency of 601 of 1933, May 12th, 1933, is never listed.
Listed where?
In the church committee's report. When they went through and investigated all of these current standing states of emergency. That was in the 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So
is 1970s.
Analyzed why that happened?
Well, I can tell you my surmise about why it's happened, and that is that, well, a couple of things. It's confusing, for one. It is confusing that it was enacted in 1933. It was declared, part of it, how much, we aren't sure, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1936. And in 1937, they came back and affirmed, validated, and reenacted without change. And so, like I said, they weren't sure how much had been thrown out. And they neglected to reenact Section 13 on how to end it. And then in 19, and that was under what they called the AMAA, the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act. And in 1938, Congress passed, again, Agricultural Adjustment Act. So you have the 1933 AAA and you have the 1938 AAA. Same name. Everybody thinks it's the same. And if you go into court, and this is what we learned when we went through the Four Farmers lawsuit, if you go into federal court and try to cite Section 601, Title 7 of 1933, the judges will stare at you blankly. They don't know what you're talking about. The only way you can refer to it is through the 1938 Agricultural Adjustment Act. Because the 33 Act was thrown out as unconstitutional.
Are there any word differences?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it was all adopted by reference. You know, we affirm, validate, and reenact this. Boom.
So what's the word difference, if that's true?
Well, over time, all kinds of things. If you look up the actual language in 601 today, you won't find reference to burdened and obstructed channels of commerce and things like that. I'm not even sure you'll find low farm prices as a phrase in the stuff.
So these are amendments since 1938.
Yeah. Well, yes. And like they say, you know, they come out with a new farm bill every 5 years, which is not true, but it's about 5 years, sometimes more, sometimes less. And they pass extensions from time to time without changing anything, just so they can get their act together and delay the work. And, you know, it depends on the politics of the day.
But the Farm Bill, when you say Farm Bill, is not the AAA.
Correct. Well, but it's all, it's all based upon the AAA. It's based upon those first steps towards regulating agriculture that happened with that Declaration of Emergency. The Declaration of Emergency was the first step, the first an opener that was used to open up agriculture for federal regulation. Up until that time, like Jerry said, the Department of Agriculture was just an information trading bureau. Now we have the Land Grant Act, which and the what was the other, the Morrill Act, which and what's the one that established the land grant stuff? I forget now. Anyway, we've had all kinds of things going on with the Agriculture Department at the federal level, but the regulation of agriculture and the spigots of federal money that get turned on and off, and the regulations on how that all happens, all began with and are dependent upon the 1933 Agricultural Adjustment Act as it was reenacted in 37, reenacted again in 38, and reenacted again in 1949 and 48 and 49. And they call the current 48-49 Farm Bill the permanent ag legislation, so that if they fail to pass a new Farm Bill and extend all of the regulation that has been built up since 1949. The saying is that we would revert back to the 1949 Farm Bill provisions.
I'm confused about this, quote, Farm Bill.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't totally replace the AAA, right? So they're
correct.
There together.
It's built upon that, yep.
Right, but they're separate bills.
Well, they modify. They are amendments to those previous acts.
Okay. As well as being a separate bill.
Well, it's a separate bill as it goes through the Congress. But it is, its intent is to provide either new or change old provisions within existing law.
But it touches all provisions in existence?
No.
Okay.
No. Just the stuff that's hot plate issue today. They've got a big uproar now going on about the dairy industry. About how we need emergency action on dairy. Oh, golly gosh, dairy. Oh, dairy. All you got to do is go out and talk to any dairy farmer and ask him if $60 a hundred milk would help his financial situation. See what he has to say.
So who's having this hubbub? The Congress, or?
Yeah.
Oh.
Farnborough, Congress, yeah, oh golly. Oh golly gosh, the situation is dire in the dairy industry. Well, let me see here. I've got there. Let me get into this and go here because I just updated this yesterday. Milk, $67. December of 2023, the USDA parity price for 100 pounds of milk is $67.
That's nothing.
Well, wait till I tell you what the actual current current market prices. Get that out of the way. Current market price is 30% of that. So 18, 21 is about $20. Not $67, but $20.
What?
$21.50, I think, is about what that works out to.
For 100 gallons of milk?
For 100 pounds of milk.
Pounds? Oh, pounds.
That's about 7 or 8 gallons.
Wow. I should buy my milk there.
Yeah, $5 a gallon. Yep.
Jeez.
But that's what the farmer's getting paid. And it should be $67.
Wow.
At least according to USDA.
So we're not even paying enough, Sue.
So it should be $10 a gallon, actually.
Yeah, $11. Well, we're paying $10.50, I think.
There you go. See, that's about a parity price, as long as that's what's being paid to the producer.
But that parity price is calculated by today's parity of the ag department, not by the norm parity.
Correct. That's not honest parity. That's USDA parity. Yep.
Gotcha.
But like I say, later, we can have that argument later as to whether USDA parity is honest or not.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between parity, as USDA defines it, and market today is so extreme, let's go to parity first. Then we can argue about whether that's honest.
Right.
Hmm. To make a point, I think I would bring up the difference between
Yeah, but like I say, it's, unless you can get somebody to understand what parity is.
Right.
And the only way you can do that is to show them what USDA does when they make that calculation.
Hmm.
I mean, the way to calculate honest parity is a whole lot simpler than what USDA does.
Can we do an explanation of that?
I can, if need be. That's what flummoxed Nick Tiedemann the first time I tried to engage him. Well, you'll have to explain to me how to calculate parity because USDA, I just can't follow it. It just doesn't make any sense. I said, you won't get an argument with me about that. It certainly doesn't make sense. I agree with you there. And that was... It is fish impression.
I think that would be good if we distinguish between those, for even just for us.
No.
No?
Not yet. No, let's just... I mean, it's a handy thing to know, but it makes no difference. I mean, if you were actually to do the honest parity calculation, which is simply the index of prices paid, expressed as the number itself, the USDA calculates index of prices paid, and it's a percent. So there's a four digit number there, like 3,956 or something like that, and that's a percentage. So you have to put a decimal point right in there. So 39.56. times the base price, which is the 1910 to 14 price of milk. That is honest parity. But frankly, milk shouldn't be on the parity list to begin with. It's not a storable commodity.
Well, they did originally, in the fight book, they're talking, and I thought I read that in Unforgiven too, that they included.
That was part of the Stiegel provisions during World War II.
That they included livestock and, well, this is for peak, so that would have been before then, that they were in the many proposals that they were floating. They came up with, I think, the Congressional Committee.
Well, yeah, everybody has their pet peeve. Everybody has their personal interest to pursue.
Well, they had, the point was that they had eight things. Cotton was on the list too, and then
tobacco.
For period of question. Well, cotton probably was because the Cotton South, there was
cotton
a lot.
Should have been on there. Should be on there. Cotton should be on the list. Cotton. Okay. If you look at the 70% of the crop acreage, what crops are produced on the bulk, 70% of our crop acreage in the nation? And you'll find there's five crops, essentially. Maybe four today. The other 30% is mostly hay, forage, and then all the rest of the minor crops plus fruits and vegetables.
But a lot of the corn and what else that's used for animal feed, when you got into pastured livestock and stuff, regenerative agriculture, the production of corn would go down, way down.
If you were grazing your livestock, yes.
Because there's so much that's being fed into the animals.
Well, yes, unjustifiably, yes. Cows are not grain eaters, they're foragers, they're graziers.
Mm-hmm.
Feed them grains.
Makes
and they
sick.
Acidify and die.
Right. Yep. It's horrific.
And what they want, of course, is dead cows anyway, because we're after the meat.
Right.
So what the hell do we care?
Yeah, we want to ban meat. That's the latest.
Right.
It's a really big thing now. Let's ban the meat so we can get the farmers and farm bugs instead.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, we got, under
eat it and you guys all like it.
Right. At least people are objecting to eating bugs, and they're not too happy with that idea.
So we got any more questions about Sadi or?
Yeah, what, should we, for next week, would we want to continue with Sadi?
Yes.
Okay, because the point, what he talks about is redemption, redeeming the capital, redemption of capital is what he calls it.
Which would be accumulated wealth.
Yeah, the previously accumulated capital that needs to be brought back into the common holding of the social group. Yep. In other words, purchased back out of the private holding, because it is the private holding that presents the problem. It's good that by your own individual effort, you get rewarded. But what we have failed to do is account for the handing over, the return of that benefit from the individual back to the society over the long haul. Because we did it to benefit the society. We wouldn't have done it otherwise. So society has a vested interest in that capital, that wealth producing system. And so it has to turn all the way around.
I have a request for next time.
Yeah.
And this is because I'm going to confess, I forgot to set my digital recorder.
Oh no!
I only have the last Zoom that Randy just said. But also, I think if we could reread that part and re-talk about it, it would help because
I agree.
Absorbed readily into my
right.
Probably soul, most people. Brain. So, and it's especially important to get it in your brain so you can encapsulate it, put it in little bullet points.
Like,
they're so wont to do. Anyway, we're going to get kicked off. So Sadi next week, same stuff.
Okay. So what I read to you about the risk of discrediting the new economics is what it was called, is in chapter 12 of
12.
Virtual Wealth and Debt.
Great.
Okie doke.
Okay. See you tonight.
Okay.
Okay. See you tonight.
Later.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.